Thanksgiving at Home with Cairo Radio, a live radio show on Thanksgiving afternoon for all the people of the Puget Sound region listening on 97.3 FM and people listening worldwide on the Cairo Radio app. I'm Felix Bunnell. Mike Lewis is with me. We're here till 6 o'clock today. We're looking at, I guess kind of a mixture of nostalgic things and Thanksgiving things. So many of us have had to change our plans because of the pandemic and are staying home for Thanksgiving this year. So we thought we would stay home with you and share some memories, talk about some history stories, talk about some people like Stan Borson, who we ended that last hour with. We knew we didn't have enough time to play the whole I Was Santa Claus at the Schoolhouse for the PTA.
It's mercifully, we didn't have enough time.
Is it an acquired taste? Did I sound like a lunatic in professing my love for Stan Borson?
I don't know. You don't sound like a – you never sound like a lunatic because of that, Felix. But I would say – it's definitely kind of trapped in time. I mean, it's like going back a little bit and listening to Spike Jones, right? You remember him, the band leader.
Very much, yeah.
Influential, actually, on people like Weird Al Yankovic and people like that. But some of the songs still are funny, and some seem definitely like preserved in amber.
Yeah, and Stan, he might be the only person to have appeared both on the Lawrence Welk Show and on Prairie Home Companion.
Well, he was an accordion.
Pretty crazy.
Was he an accordion? He was the accordion player, right?
He was, yeah. Yeah. Accordions.
There you go.
An accordion took Stan Borson a long way.
You know also that the last accordion maker in the United States is
Pitosa.
In Seattle.
Yeah.
Well, not in Seattle anymore. I think they actually, they were on Wallingford Avenue and they are on 45th Avenue in Wallingford. They moved to where? I think they are not in Seattle, but in
Mukilteo or something like that.
Yeah, they moved slightly out of town. Ended up doing a story on them because they were like the last people. But the accordion became cool again. That's the funny thing. The accordion got hip with Arcade Fire and a bunch of other bands. Accordion made a big comeback. So Stan was just of his time and a little behind his time. He actually would have been a big hit right now.
What I think is cool about Stan, I knew him pretty well. I would have him. I did this thing at Mohai back in the early 2000s called the Northwest TV Holiday Reunion. I'd have Stan Borson. I'd have J.P. Patches and Gertrude. I'd have the widow of Captain Puget, Brakeman Bill from Channel 11.
Somebody mentioned, texted in about that.
Yeah, I think it might have been my brother. But we would do this little sort of corny holiday show every year from 2000 to 2004, and people just loved it. I loved it. It was all just very self. It was like playtime for me, getting to meet these people who were my childhood idols. And what I like about Stan is that he was a regional star. I mean, he had his TV show, which ended in 1968. I mean, that's the same year I was born. But he had these record albums, and he did these concert performances. He and his wife, they led tours, like bus tours, where they would take people on long bus tours and other trips around the world and stuff. He was a very busy, very active guy, but he managed to be a regional musical star. And we don't really have those so much anymore. You either have, like, everyone in their basement with a guitar on YouTube,
right,
or you have these worldwide, famous people, but that kind of regional level, mid-level celebrity star is just kind of a thing of the past.
No, I think you're totally right. It's a good point.
And I love anything that distinguishes the region. I start to repeat myself a lot, but just stuff that makes someplace different and more interesting is like gold. And that's why, all the stuff we've talked about, the changing things, the signs that have gone away or the businesses that are changing, it's like, I don't like cling to those things and say they mustn't change, because stuff changing is what has made Seattle interesting. Every 25 years, Seattle like sheds an exoskeleton and this new city emerges. And it leaves some people behind, obviously, which isn't a good thing. But it creates these whole new sets of cultural experiences and political experiences and social things, social conditions that makes history worthwhile, right? Because if stuff never changed, it'd get pretty boring.
So I completely agree.
I embrace the dynamism. I love it. But, we can have our modern 21st century city with our bizarre problems that we struggle with even before the pandemic. But we can also play Stan Borson most of the way through the song. It's that story part of the song that kind of makes it too long. Yeah. I think it ended right where his beard had just been set fire to by the guy with the cigar. So a happy ending, though.
That does make sense that the song would end at that point. Once your beard catches on fire, really, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, well, he puts it out in the snow and he runs home. And my favorite line is, my own dog bit me 3 times before he figured out who I am. Anyway, now, speaking of weird things in the news, I saw this story earlier in the week. And I think you talked about it on your show a couple nights ago, right?
I did.
This monolith down in Utah?
Yes. I love that story. I love anybody who does something purely for the art of doing it. And that doesn't really, I mean, we don't know who did it. And we don't know, you know, and they're not getting popular or making money on it. I think it's great. It's like a Banksy almost sort of thing, right? You know,
this sort of
public art that that just appears seemingly from nowhere. I think it's great.
Yeah, and I admire the patience of somebody putting this in this basic story is they put this metal monolith in somewhere out in the wilderness in Utah and then didn't tell anybody about it. And it was only discovered by either Forest Service or state foresters doing some kind of survey. And they noticed this shining, gleaming thing down and they landed and took a closer look at it. And it's this tall metal pylon.
It's 12 feet tall.
Nowhere. Yeah. and they haven't figured it out, right? They still don't know who did it, right?
No, they still don't know who did it.
Okay. And then, but then it made me start thinking about, and I think you're thinking the same way, about 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago, when a similar thing happened in Seattle on New Year's Day 2001. And you told me you actually covered that for the PI 20 years ago.
I did. In fact, it was just when we were ending our strike, the newspaper strike. I think it was one of the first stories
right.
I did when I got back into the newsroom was this monolith appearing at Sandpoint Magnuson Park out on Lake Washington. And it was from... Literally, they left no tracks. It was absolutely just came up there on, of course, New Year's Day 2001, which was the point of it. The joke of it is that this monolith appears in the movie 2001, and when the monolith appears, it sort of portends this great evolutionary jump in what these kind of proto-human primates into actual humans. Like they have this great awareness. And I don't know that it actually worked on us in the same fashion here in Seattle. But nonetheless, it got very popular like immediately. And I got to say, my hat's off to, and I even said this at the time 20 years ago, my hat's off to the park rangers out there, the park supervisors out there at Sandpoint, because they took it in good humor, which is exactly what they should have done. People kept flocking to see it, and then it disappeared as mysteriously as it came. And I found out years later that I know someone, in fact, I live with her, who was a part of the crew who actually put that thing up. And I didn't know. I'd been living with her for years before I knew that she was actually involved in the Seattle monolith prank.
And, you know, I looked, it's on Wikipedia now, the whole backstory. I didn't know it was there. I thought it was still, part of it was still a mystery, because before the thing appeared in January 2001, I was involved in a fundraiser for it. I think it was December 2nd, 2000. It was early December of 2000. They had this thing called the Apes of Wrath. it was an amateur wrestling event, one of the most surreal things I've ever been to. My childhood friend I've known since fourth grade, Ken Zick, we were in a band together. We've been good friends for almost 45 years. He and I were announcer one and announcer two, and we stood up on a table. It was in the little building. I drove by it the other day. It's still there on Westlake Avenue, kind of in the middle of all those giant buildings now. Looked like some kind of a wood building, a workshop maybe made in the 20s or something. And all these people were packed in there, and then dozens of people put on very elaborate, what's it called? Is it Luca Libra or Lucha Libra? Whatever that Mexican style of very, very colorful wrestling is.
Yeah, very theatrical wrestling with the masks and the colorful costumes.
And there was nudity and stuff. There were people wearing these really twisted, like, metal costumes. It had this sort of weird kind of, like, kind of a bizarre, almost like erotic component to it, too. But my friend Ken and I stood up on this table. We had, like, suits and bow ties on. We had a PA system. And we sort of did this kind of play-by-play and tried to be kind of make witty repartee describing what the wrestlers were doing. And I don't know how much effort had gone into the individual wrestling performances, but it was pretty elaborate. It was all these crazy, crazy costumes and people, like, you know, rolling around on the floor and people yelling and screaming. And I actually, while we were doing that, we had a boombox with us, and I recorded probably 2 hours of that whole show. And I pulled out, I found the tape, and I pulled out a little bit. We have a little snippet. This is, I think, when the police show up at the event. Do we have this audio?
We do have this audio. I'm firing it right now.
So, okay, so let's get this straight. We're going into
the Seattle's finest have stopped to visit us out in front. Unless you would please hold on for a moment.
Okay. Have they signed up?
We need our designated spokespeople to come to the door, please. I believe that's Joe and Kim. Is that correct? We need a spokesperson to speak with Seattle's finest out in front.
I got to say, Felix, One of the things about you that I find so continually impressive is that you understand that right now, at some point, becomes history. And you're always ready to record or document what's going on as it's going on. And that is fantastic. And what would have been even better is if it had it turned just out to be more wrestlers in costume, and then they got involved in the, you know, because so have some fake police arrive, and then they get involved in the big fight in the middle of the ring. That would have been funny.
Yeah, I love that snippet because one of my favorite bands is a band called The Replacements from the
Twin Cities. I know The Replacements, right.
They have an EP called the Stink EP, which they issued quickly after their first record came out. They wrote a bunch of songs, and it starts out with a tape of the Minneapolis Police Department breaking up a party. And, like, you know, there's all these people shouting obscenities and stuff and everything. That's a really famous thing. So that to me is like a little tribute to The Replacements there.
But nice.
Yeah, no, it's neat to hear that you have a connection to that event. Because I'm sometime later in December, I'm going to do a story about that and play some more of that wrestling audio on Seattle's Morning News just to make Dave Ross uncomfortable. All right. This show, we're talking about the past and talking about how we're spending Thanksgiving. We're checking in with different Cairo voices around the region. We talked to Sully last hour, Chris Sullivan. We're going to talk to Nick Allard in the 5 o'clock hour. Maybe he'll give us a special Thanksgiving forecast, too. But I think we might have Ursula Reutin on the line with us now. Is Ursula ready to join us on the big show? I'm not hearing anything.
I'm hearing some sound.
Okay.
But I'm not sure I'm hearing anything more than that.
Ursula's, I think, is like opening some cans of cranberry sauce right now. I can hear the can opener. It's theater of the mind. She's putting on a show. She's always putting on a show for us.
Maybe it's Morse code?
Do you guys in here? We're doing the live turkey on air. I'm going to connect with Ursula and make sure we can get her and not the turkey she's cooking right now. So,
all right, we'll come back to Ursula. But I love that wrestling event is cool. I think the monolith itself, is it actually still under the Fremont Bridge? That's the last place I saw it maybe 15 years ago was under the Fremont Bridge.
I don't think it's there anymore. It okay. ended up, remember, it appeared there. And as a side note, my girlfriend, Mary, who was part of the crew with Caleb, Caleb's guy who led the charge and put the thing in, she actually still is irritated because she lost like a couple of rings she really liked when they were digging the hole in advance to as a base for the monolith.
Wow.
So those are still out there somewhere in Sandpoint if you want to go out and find them. And remember, then it got removed mysteriously and floated over to Duck Island?
Duck Island to Green Lake, yeah.
Yeah, got dumped there for a period of time as well. It turns out there's not a good market for a monolith.
And I don't think you could get away with that kind of thing anymore because that was actually pre 9/11 by about 9 months or 8 months.
Well,
I guess.
And pre surveillance state, like it now, you can't do anything without there being a camera out somewhere. So no, you're totally right because they literally had no idea. There were no tracks leading to it. It appeared it was as far as city pranks go, that the ball and chain on the hammering man. There's been some really good pranks. I'm a big fan of like non-violent, non-injuring. Pranks when a high school class does it or when some you know rabble rousers in his town do it. I'm a huge fan of that kind of stuff.
You know, my favorite one of those was the underwater billboard hoax that Ivers pulled off about 10 years ago with help from Paul Dorpat. You know,
I don't remember that one.
Oh man, they did this thing where they said that divers had discovered an underwater billboard that Ivar Haglund of Ivers Restaurants had created back in the 1950s as a gimmick, you know, for submarines. And so they had these elaborate YouTube videos of these like barnacle encrusted and seaweed wrapped billboards being brought up from the deep. And they played it out. I think it was several weeks. Paul Dorpat, who's the wonderful local historian and an old neighbor of mine. I saw him in the middle of all that. And because he's been the Ivers historian for a long time. And I said, hey, Paul, those Ivers built, what a cool thing you're working on. That's amazing you guys are finding that stuff. And in retrospect, he was so cagey and weird when I said that to him. Like, he changed the subject. He said, hey, you ever heard about this photographer in Eastern Washington who took all these pictures of these bridges? He just totally changed the subject. And I didn't really figure it out until later because about 2 weeks later, when it came out that the whole thing was a hoax, I didn't feel bad. I actually wrote a thing for Crosscut where I said something like, the headline was, I forgive you, Ivers and Paul Dorpat too, or something. Because, like you said, it was a totally harmless joke. And I know the Seattle Times at one point suspended Paul and said, like, you know, because he used to do a weekly column, Seattle Now and Then, and they said, like, you know, because of this, you know, the I don't know what they call it, a prank or a hoax, or because of the dishonesty that, you know, we can't necessarily have Paul Dorpat working for the paper. Fortunately, they got over that. and reinstated him pretty quickly. But that was a fabulous prank.
Is Paul one of the founders of HistoryLink as well?
I think he's one of the three founders. Yeah, I think it's considered Paul,
Crowley, Walt Crowley,
and I think Lorraine McConaghy.
That's
from
right.
Ohio.
That's right.
I think they're the three founders. Yeah. Three great people. And we, Walt passed away a long time ago. Paul retired recently, and he's slowed down a bit. But I talked to him on the phone probably 3 weeks ago, and trade emails with him every now and then. But he's just a great local historian and a
Absolutely.
Big inspiration to me. Hey, while we're waiting for Ursula, let's play this. Let's play a little bit of this song here. And then if she becomes available, we'll bump out of it. But let's hear about 30 seconds of this little song here. You got it handy for us?
I do indeed. Just a second.
Okay.
Here we go.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me.
We can have Ursula whether she wants it or not.
Santa baby, just hurry down the chimney. Santa baby.
Pop that down a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about what this is we're listening to. We're talking about audio artifacts.
Yes.
along with the when we do the radio play every year, which of course we're not doing it with a live in-person audience this year because of the pandemic. But for the last, 4 or 5 years, we started doing these little warm-up routines before the show. And Dave Ross and Ursula Roytine are always just eager to participate and willing to put on these goofy little acts there. And that's Dave doing the backing vocals there on Santa Baby. Dave did a wonderful, he did Monster Mash a couple of years ago when we did the show at the Triple Door, which, what a great venue that is. Mike, I'm not really much of a singer. I played in a band and I can kind of play guitar a little bit, but we work with so many very talented people. I always sort of feel bad when I'm not as talented as they are.
I've participated for the first time in the radio play this year that we just did for Halloween.
Fabulous.
Walk in the Dark. And I am always stunned when I look at, because it's not like newspaper people tend to not be performative, except except maybe in tantrum form. And radio people are so different because they're so extrovert. We had so many people in this room who can actually sing and actually play an instrument and pull off a song like this. I mean, this is obviously Dave Ross and Ursula Roytine, and they sound fantastic, right? And you can just tap this reservoir of talent when you do this live radio play stuff. For me, it's super impressive because I have literally zero of these skills. I got fired by my piano teacher when I was 7. He went to my mom and said, "Stop. We have to stop this."
I'm always amazed. These guys do it with very little rehearsal. I mean, you saw how little rehearsal we did for the radio play this year. That was another panic-stricken moment for me for the Halloween show, is usually when we do them live with an audience, we do a dress rehearsal at about 5 o'clock on the night of the show. And I remember my wife was asked me, "Are you going to do the dress rehearsal for the?" And I realized, I didn't schedule a dress rehearsal. So we pulled that show off back in October with very little preparation. And that's why radio is so great. You don't have to memorize. Obviously, everything you and I have been talking about for the last 90 minutes has been memorized.
Right. Exactly. We're scripted people.
It's great with a radio play. You have the words right in front of you. You're not having to memorize your blocking or where you're where you're walking, what part of the stage you're on, or anything like that. So it's wonderfully, for someone like me who doesn't like to do a huge amount of intense preparation to make something come off. I like the more spontaneity, the spontaneous form of radio.
A friend of mine who was, we haven't stayed in touch, but he was a member of the local band, the Walkabouts, that they were reasonably popular in their day. And he told me a really interesting theory about live performance, that the reason that we do it, the reason that we crave it or that we like it is because it doesn't sound recorded. So it doesn't sound like something that is, it has that spontaneity and it's a little rough around the edges. And I think that actually is what makes it great.
Now, wait, who is your friend in the Walkabouts? Is it Grant?
Bruce.
Bruce. Okay. My band, the Pink Slips, that was our final show when the band disintegrated. We opened for the Walkabouts at the Squid Row in May of 1988. That was the last show ever of my band.
Really?
32 years ago. Yeah, opening for the Walkabouts.
Wow, there you go. What was the name of your band?
In a few years. The Pink Slips.
The Pink Slips, that's a good name.
Look on YouTube. There's a couple songs on YouTube. Some of them have as many as 200 views.
Well, they're going to have 201 shortly.
All right. Well, We got the news coming up in a few minutes, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about weather. I love history. I also love weather. We've had some great storms on Thanksgiving Day or on and around Thanksgiving. And I don't mean the storms that destroy property or that hurt or kill people, but just storms that kind of make us stop what we're doing, kind of like the pandemic, but for a much shorter time period. So it's the Thanksgiving at Home with Cairo Radio Show. I'm Felix Bunnell and Mike Lewis. Thanksgiving at Home with Cairo Radio, a live radio special here on Thanksgiving afternoon with me, Felix Bunnell, and Mike Lewis. Hope you're having a wonderful Thanksgiving wherever you are around Puget Sound today. Weather's been pretty calm today. There's a little bit of rain earlier. Certainly not very windy. And one of the things, you know, I guess it's cheap entertainment to be really focused on big storms. I can remember watching, you know, the rare thunder and lightning storms or getting excited about big windstorms or snowstorms in particular when I was a little kid. So I love when they would cancel school. That was always my favorite thing. And still, even now, if I'm laying in bed early in the morning and they go through that list of the alphabetical list of the school districts being closed, which they don't do that so much anymore. They direct people to the internet, of course. But if I hear someone say, you know, alphabetically, it goes, you know, the gets to the part of the alphabet with the L's and they say Lake Washington School District closed. Part of me gets like, I cheer, I kind of raise my fist and cheer for that's even though I have nothing to do with Lake Washington School District and haven't since 1986. I still love it when they shut down. So,
well, but Felix, you know what's happening now though, as a result, I mean, one of the many bad things that has happened as a result of the pandemic. And I guess there are several linings out there, certainly. But one of the things that I didn't even think about till I saw a story in this about this in the New York Times is it may have effectively and forever killed the snow day.
I know. I saw that. And, you know, they're already headed this way. Like, my daughter graduated from Holy Names a couple of years ago, and there were a couple snow days her senior year. And the school assigned homework. They sort of they had all the teachers send materials to kids by email that they were supposed to work on. It really ruined it. And I think you're right. I think it's probably going to be a just a fact of life that it's never not going to be a way of getting freedom for a day to go out and play in the snow. So
it's heartbreaking in a weird way.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's one terrible thing.
And the one great thing about one of the great things about Seattle is that it was one of the only places I've ever lived that actually had snow semi regularly. But also, you had adult snow days, too, as one of the few places on the planet where seriously, you remember, it would even get slightly cold and then be like, all right, everyone, stay home. You know, we don't want you out there driving. And I was like, I always spent my time in Seattle as a reporter, so that just meant it was more work, not less. But I did appreciate the fact that you actually, as an adult, got a snow day, and that's probably going away, too, as a result of this ridiculously effective Zoom garbage, you know, like... It's awful because we want our snow day back. What we need to do is resolutely demand that we get at least one every winter.
Well, I mean the weird thing is I used to fantasize about I did a Christmas Eve radio show from 1999 to 2004 on KBCS, the station over at Bellevue College.
Great station, by the way. Great station.
Yeah, and I'd have to drive over there. Like, I didn't know. I was naive, and I asked, can I do a show on Christmas Eve, thinking that it was some coveted broadcast spot on the schedule. And they're like, hey, get a load of this guy. He wants to be on their station on Christmas Eve. And they said, sure, come on down. And I'd be on the air from, I don't know, 9 or 10 o'clock until 2 in the morning, playing lots of Stan Borson, not surprisingly. And old, you know, news cuts from World War II with Edward R. Murrow talking about, you know, it's a quiet Christmas in London, 1940, and the bombs have fallen down. It was just a sort of very nostalgic kind of Christmas-focused thing. Anyway. I forget where I was going with that. Oh, I know where I was going. I used to fantasize, God, I'd love to do that show on Christmas Eve, but do it from my house. You know, because the technology to do what I'm doing now, sitting in my basement, talking on this device and sounding like I'm on the radio, has been around for a while, but there wasn't any reason to have someone like me do a show from their house. So along with the snow day going away, the fact I can be here at Thanksgiving, and God, at the next break, I'm going to go upstairs and get the turkey in the oven. I have a smoked turkey that needs to be heated up. So I might check out of this early, this next segment. No, just kidding. But it is pretty amazing to be able to do that. So yeah, technology is changing a lot. But before we get too far off track here, I want to talk about big storms because many people, and I'd love, if you have memories of this, I'd love to hear it on the text line at 98973. and help confirm a crackpot theory I've developed about the Turkey Day storm of 1983. This was a very ill-timed wind that blew in the morning and late afternoon, early afternoon of November 24th, 1983, into the Puget Sound area. Not a crazy high wind event, but, you know, 40-mile-per-hour sustained winds, gusts around 55 or 60. But the timing was such that something like 270,000 customers were without electricity in the middle of the day in the early afternoon, when most people would have been trying to cook their turkeys on their electric ovens and were, you know, and were sort of defeated in that attempt. And in doing this, I go around the state giving talks about weather history, this thing called Storm Warning. I'm with Humanities Washington. I go to these remote libraries and museums. It's a really fun project. And I talk about these storms. And I always have people, I have people raise their hand and answer questions. And it seems like here in Puget Sound, that was the first year that a lot of people were inspired to cook their turkeys on their barbecue grills because they had no other choice. And then they just started doing it like that from then on because it worked out so well. And it kind of became this sort of micro trend about people barbecuing their turkeys. So my crackpot theory is that it all began with the big storm that was, what is that, 37 years ago, 2 days ago. And I love named storms. This sort of idea of free entertainment, whether it's listening to the radio or, you know, watching storms out the window, and that excitement of when the power goes out. And I don't know, I guess when you're a kid, it's exciting when the power goes out. When you're an adult, it's just sort of like you start worrying about stuff in the refrigerator and worrying about whether or not you'll be able to get ready for work the next day and that sort of thing. But now you've been here 20 years. Have there been big windstorms or big snowstorms that have stuck with you?
Well, I mean, obviously the one that may have gotten us a new mayor is probably the biggest standout one. I mean, yeah. Remember when they declined, and I think unfairly to some degree, Greg Nichols took a lot of heat. He acknowledges as well for not plowing the streets. We didn't really have much by way of snowplows, but they even declined to salt the streets as well, saying that.
Yes.
And I never quite understood the idea that the salt might wash into the salt water in the Puget Sound. But I think that really was because the city was tied up for 2 weeks. Now, on my end of things, I went on these long walks in the city and no one was out and it was beautiful. But for a lot of people, particularly people who were housebound, it was difficult. You couldn't get, that was pre-delivery everything, right? So it was difficult on a lot of people and it was chaotic, but that would be by far the biggest storm that I would remember here in town.
Yeah, that's, I remember, Greg Nichols gave himself a B+ for the storm response in a press conference.
It wasn't what the voters gave him.
Haunting him. Yeah, and then he didn't, he failed to make it through the primary in the election the next summer.
Mike McGinn became mayor.
Yeah. And Nichols, he's a great mayoral historian. He knows his Seattle history.
Absolutely,
better than
he does. He knows a ton about
Seattle mayor.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in our next little, after the break here, we're going to talk about some more holiday music. We're going to go back to Tacoma. A guy named Don Wilson and a guy named Bob Bogle, who put together a little combo that went on to sell something like 15 billion records around the world. But they had this fabulous Christmas record in 1965. And yes, of course, I'm talking about The Ventures here on Cairo Radio. It's Thanksgiving at Home with Felix Bunnell and Mike Lewis.
Welcome back, Cairo Radio. I'm Mike Lewis. Felix Bunnell is here. I think he's still here, unless he's gone to smoke a turkey. Felix, are you there?
It's so hard keeping the darn thing lit.
I know, but thank goodness that smoking turkey is finally legal in Washington State.
Corniest jokes you'll get to find anywhere on the radio, live or taped, anywhere in the
holiday.
Country or the world.
They put us in the seat. It's their problem for doing so. So I've got a couple of text messages for you. I'm taking no blame for this. I've got a couple of text messages for you. So here is one where I'm looking for it. Now I just scrolled down. All right, here it is. Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is from 425. So great to hear you. I am stepping out of the shadows to admit I was a proud Stan Borson accordion band member with my sister. So there you go. We actually have a Stan Borson accordion band. I don't know if that means he actually was in Stan's band or whether he was just a big fan and decided to imitate him. He and his sister decided to imitate him. Another nice one, Brilliant Stories, History, and Banter. Thank you, folks, for being here. We've gotten some, I've got to say, thank you, texters. It's nice to know people are out there with nothing better to do than to listen to us. It's delightful to be getting the text. So keep them coming, 98973. And Felix, you want to talk a bit about a very famous, or at least once famous, local band.
Oh yeah, and they're rock and roll members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're inducted. No, they were inducted about 10 years ago. It's the Ventures from Tacoma. It was just two young guys, Don Wilson and Bob Bogle, that were just got a couple of guitars and some chord books and started teaching themselves some songs. And Don Wilson's mom, Josie Wilson, I interviewed Don many years ago for the Seattle Channel. Actually, when they were getting inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and spent a lot of time with them out at his house over on the east side, and learned a lot about how the band came together, just as when it was just a two-piece band. And they recorded over at a studio in West Seattle. And then this 45 of this song, Walk Don't Run, which was probably their most famous song ever. And Pat O'Day played it on KJR. Pat O'Day passed away earlier this year. That's another sad thing that happened in 2020. We'll talk about that some other time. But we've lost a lot of great people this year.
We have.
Excuse me. Anyway, so the Ventures were just an incredible instrumental band that just took the world by storm with all these crazy hits like Walk Don't Run. And they were one of those great quirky things where they were very popular in Japan, sold more records in Japan than the Beatles.
Wow.
And they were still touring in Japan, a lot of the original members, because they added a bass player and a drummer and everything. I think they were a four or five piece at their fullest complement in the late 60s. And so they were still touring as recently as a decade or so ago. And they're just iconic rock and roll band. And somehow or other, one of the members, and Don Wilson said it was his idea when I asked him about it 10 years ago, for their Christmas record, because there was a certain time in America when everybody put out a Christmas record. It was a way to make money. It was a way to sort of cash in on, the holidays, because everybody had these turntables and wanted to play these big records. And so they put out a Christmas record. I think it's just called the Ventures Christmas Album from 1965. It's got the head of the guitar with the tuning pegs and the wires on it, or the strings. It's a pretty iconic record cover. If you saw it, you know what I mean. And it had about 12 or so Christmas songs on it. And they're not just Christmas songs. They're Christmas songs as if filtered through specific sort of Ventures songs. The one that's the most famous, which we'll probably play that later in the show, is Sleigh Ride, which is kind of filtered as if it was filtered through Walk Don't Run, all these, multiple guitars going full speed and all this just really, really cool instrumental stuff. But it was just a brilliant idea, because it took their brand, which was this sort of kind of surfy instrumental sounding, but just very, very, very powerful guitar sound. And then these sort of familiar Christmas melodies all completely worked around to make them sound as if the Ventures were playing. Just a brilliant thing. And it's amazing that it's just one of these iconic records that has stood the test of time. And I swear, if you're going to be in any kind of retail setting in the next couple of days, which I guess might be kind of a stretch, it's just now dawning on me how much people are not hearing Muzak and other kinds of canned music during the pandemic, right?
Silver lining.
But they're at the holidays, though. You love hearing holiday music.
No, silver lining.
Anyway, and so the Ventures are this incredible, incredible local band from Tacoma, went on to incredible fame, and I think several of the members have passed away. I think Noki Edwards was the lead guitarist who joined the band, along with Don Wilson and Bob Bogle. He passed away a couple of years ago. But this Christmas record, we're going to play a song from it in a second, but if you can get a hold of the CD, do people still buy CDs? I have my Ventures CD, but I don't know. Is everything online now with music? I guess I'm kind of out of step with
Weirdly the enough, CDs are harder to get than vinyl. Vinyl has become so popular again that there's a lot of stores in Seattle selling a lot of vinyl, but CDs are just sort of became like the cassette.
It's what hipsters buy nowadays, vinyl. Yeah.
But I love CDs because of the booklets. The liner notes in a CD booklet are just about perfect. We're on a record, it's kind of hit or miss. It might be printed on the dust sleeve inside the LP cover. It might be on a separate piece of paper, or there might be nothing. It seems like with every good CD or every good CD reissue, there's good liner notes. But
to push back on that, because if you folks don't know, Felix and I can argue about minutia for hours. I would say that albums brought the when we reduced it to CDs and then reduced it further to just MP3 files, we lost album art. And album art was, I think, superior to even getting the good liner notes. Although I got to be, I'm like you, I always read the liner notes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that Ventures CD that I have doesn't have liner notes, but we're going to hear a song. It's called Snowflakes. It's a Ventures version of Greensleeves or What Child Is This, sort of filtered through mid-60s instrumental surf rock. Take it away, Don Wilson and the Ventures. We'll be right back.
Thank you.